Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LeDuc. If Then is a new musical that began previews at the Richard Rogers Theater in New York City last night. With music by Tom Kitt, book and lyrics by Brian Yorkey, and directed by Michael Greif, the show reunites the Tony and Pulitzer Prize-winning team who created 2009's Next to Normal. The production further reunites Greif with acclaimed actors Idina Menzel and Anthony Rapp. This is Rapp singing You Don't Need to Love Me from If Then. It was recorded at the Green Space in New York City as part of their Inside Look Broadway series.
You don't need to love me or tell me that you do. Don't make me any promises. Just promise we're not through. Don't give me one damn thing. I won't let you call this greed. Just let me give to you. That's the only thing I need. I know that this can work. If you plant one simple seed, you'd see it grow. You don't need to love me to know.
Rapp previously worked with Greif and Menzel on the hit Pulitzer and Tony Award-winning musical Rent by Jonathan Larson. The cast of If Then also features LaShawns, the Tony Award-winning star of the musical adaptation of The Color Purple. Anthony Rapp's other Broadway credits are You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, 6 Degrees of Separation, and Precious Sons. He has numerous other stage and screen credits, including Adventures in Babysitting, Dazed and Confused, and the film adaptation of Rent. He joins us now, Anthony Rapp. Welcome back to the Roundtable.
Thank you very much.
We'll start by talking about the structure of If Then. What's unique about the timeline in the show?
Well, in the first scene, you see Idina Menzel's character, Elizabeth. It's her first day back in New York, and she gets reacquainted with my character, Lucas, who's an old college friend, and then one of her new friends, meets us both in the park, and at some point in that first scene, it's literally as simple and sort of mundane as, does she go with me, or does she go with Kate from there? Which doesn't seem like it's a monumental decision by any means, but then the show follows her story in going with me or her story in going with Kate. And it jumps timelines from that point till the end of the show. And you'd be surprised the kinds of different ripple effects that those small decisions can have.
Tell us about your character, Lucas.
Lucas is Elizabeth's college roommate, and we've remained friends over these years, even though she moved to Phoenix after getting married. We have a very, very strong friendship, and also, you know, you could say a somewhat complicated friendship, I guess you could say. But it's very rich stuff to work with as an actor, and to have Idina to work opposite is incredibly fortunate and rewarding.
Any press you've done for the show when it was in D.C. and here, they're asking you how it is to work with Idina Menzel again. So I'm going to ask you how it is to work with LaShawns.
Well, LaShawns is somebody that I've admired from, I think it was 91 or whenever I saw him once on this island. I was pretty young. I mean, that show, it was like a burst of joy coming off the stage, joy and life and heart and soul, and LaShawns was at the center of that. So she had always been somebody that I've been really drawn to. And then we had met like years ago in this little tiny independent film. We had one day together. We were hanging out on set. So we had that nice connection. And we would every once in a while sort of run into each other around the city, but we'd never really worked together. So the first day that we did the first workshop that we did together of this piece, it felt like an arrival of something that had kind of wanted to happen for a long time. And it's a complete pleasure. I mean, she is all of those things that I felt from being an audience member on Once on This Island all those years ago. She absolutely embodies in every fiber for being on and off stage.
The process by which a new musical comes to Broadway is a long, long journey, and it takes a long time, and there's a lot to it. What about that process? It's not the first time you've done it, of course. Do you enjoy? Do you mind how long it takes?
The time involved in continuing to chip away at something to make it better, I don't mind that. I mean, things sort of need to stew and cook, and sometimes, you know, like, John Guare wrote 6 Degrees of Separation pretty quickly. You know, he wrote it very, very quickly. And then the first read-through that we did of it in the first day of rehearsal, it didn't change a lot from then until Broadway. That sometimes happens too, But more often than not, especially with a musical, because the element of music being interwoven with storytelling makes everything that much more complicated. It just takes longer to really continue to be able to see exactly what it is that you have. Because there are so many elements, sitting around a table, you can read a play sitting around a table and it can really tell you almost all you need to know about what's working, what isn't. Mm-hmm. And then you keep learning more when it is in front of an audience. Sure. But whereas a musical, you can learn a lot about what's working and isn't working, but really until you have all the things coming together, including the orchestrations, including the lighting and all that stuff, in front of an audience and telling a 2.5-hour story from beginning to end and really feeling how everything collides and flows together, you can't know. So that's why it's important to have this time. Mm-hmm. And we've been so fortunate that David Stone, our producer, has had the experience and willingness and belief in giving something time, which is what he did with Next Normal, which is what he's doing with this, that, you know, there's no crunch to like push it through before it's ready, you know, although it's also important to have deadlines and schedule, but there still has always been a sense that it's a living, breathing thing and you need to let it become what it needs to become in the fullness of time.
Does it take, do you think, a specific temperament or a special kind of artist from the creative team to the producers to the cast to go through this process and put the time in that a work needs?
I think the temperament involved in developing something over time is the willingness to have iterations, that the versions you keep trying until you really arrive at the thing that works the best, and you don't settle, you know, you don't just sort of go, oh well, that kind of works, you know, and even if sometimes it's a question of, even if something is working very well, there you might discover like the domino effect, that maybe if you move this one little thing over here, that might then require you to make some changes to something that is working well already, but maybe it's going to work even better, you know. So it requires people who are willing to continue to take that step back and look at the big picture and not get attached to individual moments or, you know, it really is not about ego. It's about the greater good of trying to create something that tells a unified story in a meaningful way.
Are you glad to be working with Michael Greif again?
Well, Michael Greif is somebody that I've known for a very long time. Also, and he's a director from my first experiences with him working on Rent through now, who very much loves process. He loves working at something and continuing to investigate. He, you know, a lot of directors, when they have a big successful show, yes, they'll come back to the theater every once in a while and sort of check in on it, but it's like this machine that they created and then it just runs and it goes. Michael continued to go to Rent all the time, give notes, talk to people who were replacement casts. He was involved in every future production of it that there's ever been. And it's not simply because he wants to control all of it. It's that, like, when we went back and did the Broadway tour in 09 and 10, we made other new changes to it. It was a living, breathing piece of art, a living, breathing thing that he wanted to keep investigating as an artist. And that's what this whole process has been from the moment of day one as well. So that's remarkable.
You had a run in D.C. of If Then. What did you learn while you were on stage with audiences down there?
Well, we learned one thing is that it was really funny. Like, when you're working on a show, it's not like an out-and-out comedy, but there's a lot of funny stuff in it. Mm-hmm. But when you're working on a show in a room, everybody gets used to the jokey moments or the funny moments, and so they don't get, you know, you sort of forget in a way that they're laughs. Unless you, like, I imagine people are working on, like, Bullets Over Broadway or something, which is, like, a really, you know, with punchlines like that.
Yeah.
You know, they you sort of build in the production to be that way. With ours, we knew there would be some funny things, but you never know exactly how it's going to play. So one thing in D.C. was, like, the laughs were so full, and you know, when it's not, they weren't just sort of titters or giggles. It was like you could feel the laughs going all the way from the front row to the back row and coming back. And it didn't mean simply that the audiences were thinking something's funny, but it also means they were engaged and caring about something, because so many of the laughs in the show are sort of character or situational, mm-hmm. or, you know, in a relationship, you know, nuancey, subtle things, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. So if they're responding in that way, that meant that they were getting invested, which was very encouraging. And then we just, you know, heard a lot of very specific things sort of repeated from different corners about what was maybe a little confusing or not as clear or, you know, had question marks about. And that's the stuff that the team continually through the weeks that we were in D.C., we were making changes every day until we couldn't anymore. And then that whole baggage of information, just not only from the people in the audience, but also themselves watching it every night. That's the stuff that we've been implementing in the rehearsals for New York.
Why and how is Tom Kitt so good? Which I think he is. Not that he needs me to think that, but I agree that he is.
You know, Tom Kitt and Jonathan Larson, you know, they're writers who grew up on both musical theater music and really good singer-songwriter music. You know, pop, rock, folk stuff. So they have an ear to me that is incredibly melodic and catchy and singable, but they also are very interested in storytelling. I think that Tom had the right instincts for being able to find the ways to blend those influences and have his own voice. But that's, you know, as a singer, it's all well and good to sing a song that has a cool melody, but if the melody itself and the way that the song is phrased doesn't express the emotional content of the song, then it doesn't help very much.
Sure.
So that's the great thing, is that Tom understands all aspects of songwriting for theater. That is also, to my ear, feels in line with contemporary music language.
How much of a driver of your career can you be at this point, you personally? Because I think, being a fan of Rent since it came out, Anthony Rapp is a huge star. He must be able to do whatever he wants and choose whatever projects he wants. But then anytime I talk to somebody about something like that, they're like, no, you have to audition and you hope something good comes along. And I was just wondering how in charge of your path have you been, or do you hope to be?
I'm a little more. The way that I'm in charge in any way, I guess, is what I say yes and no to. But you know, and in recent years, I've gotten more and more like cool things kind of offered to me. You know, like a cool little independent film, and you know, very wonderful tiny hour-long production of Hamlet that I got to do. You know, stuff like that has been very meaningful. And because I'm not having to scrape by for money, I don't have to like grind away to try to get stupid TV gigs that I wouldn't really want to do, you know. I mean, I would like to do good TV gigs when they're cool. Like, I got to do an episode of SVU that was really fantastic. I got to work with Charles Grodin, and, I mean, really good material. So I'm not, like, a snob about the medium, but I'm a sort of becoming more of a snob about the material and the opportunities of the kind of stuff I want to work on. And I can afford to be a little choosy in terms of that. Sometimes my representatives get a little mad that I, like, do like to commit to these small weird things sometimes, because it takes me out of the contention maybe for other things, but I'd rather do something that's real than maybe wait around for something that's fantasy that hasn't yet happened, you know. So I guess in terms of that, I'm probably a little unusual. I don't know. I feel very, very grateful in this case in particular to be working with so many people that I've had such a long relationship with, because there's such a sense of the history is so important, I think, to the kind of work we know we can do with each other. And so it gives such a freedom to the process. And no one has to impress anybody. You know, there's already a shared respect and admiration and love and collaboration that exists. So then all there is to do the work. And that's, I've been a professional actor for 3 years, which is a really long time, so I hope that I've earned some of that, you know, and it feels like that's bearing fruit.
You don't need to love me to let me help you through. You don't need to confide in me. I've got crap enough for two. You don't need to answer. I'll know before you do. But hear me and believe me that you don't need to love me. The way that I love you.
Anthony Rapp stars in If Then, currently in previews at the Richard Rogers Theater on West 46th Street in New York City. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.